We love bringing you the Rufus Project each fortnight, and we really hope that you enjoy listening to it. But you know what? You can help us keep this podcast free and, I suppose, increase its profile. How can you do this? Well, first up, the easiest way is to just share us on social media. Share the podcast, talk about perhaps one of the sections that you liked, tell people about the competitions. If we're having a movie competition that is a movie that they like, that would be fantastic. You can also leave us a review on iTunes, or just give us some feedback on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Podomatic, Ustream. The list is almost endless. If you do happen to have a little bit of spare cash laying around, well, you can also head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and hit that donate button. We would be very, very appreciative, and we're hoping to set up some sort of reward system in the not-too-distant future. Maybe you want something a bit more substantial. Guess what? We have a Spreadshirt store where you can buy men's, ladies' and kids' t-shirts with a huge range of one design at the moment based around our very public domain mascot that you might see on the little podcast picture. It would make a great talking point and again would certainly help us promote the podcast. Just head to the Rufus Project .spreadshirt.com.au to browse our fine selection of one design. Finally, if you have a product or service that you think may be of interest to the Rufus Project listeners, then please contact us at rufusreviews@gmail.com. Anyway, that's enough of this stuff. Let's get on with the podcast. And welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to, or whatever geeky movie eventy things that we think is interesting at the time. I am your host, Trevor Holland, and you will also be hearing from my good friend and king of cult cinema in Brisbane, Christian Fletcher. But I hear you asking, what do we have in store for you this fortnight? Well, we've got a bit of a briefer episode this time, and I'm pretty sure some people out there are heaving a sigh of relief. No game to review, but I did manage to see Gone Girl, and I'll let you know what I thought of that just a little bit later. Christian's birthday is coming up. Happy birthday, Christian. So he has decided to indulge himself and give us a rundown of his top 10 favourite movies. There are some great movies in here, and maybe just one or two surprises. Redeeming features goes to a movie that always, always is listed in worst movie lists and has even been dubbed the best worst movie ever. You just wait to find out about that one. In the local wildlife section, I had a chat to sit down with Willem Whitfield. You may have heard him before on the podcast, but this time he is the director, producer, and appearing in quite an amazing sounding play, so definitely stay tuned for that one. We also have a bit of a different competition, so again, if you want to win stuff, just keep on listening. But for now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast. Well, the geek news in Australia for the last fortnight really has been dominated by one main subject. That is our illustrious government actually putting forward the legislation to start the data retention laws and basically make the internet providers keep all this wonderful data on us, including location data from phones. Think about that. An accurate map of every place you've been over the space of 2 years, kept for a further 2 years. That doesn't sound creepy at all. Now, I won't bury the lead on this. While it wasn't defeated, the opposition actually, in an astounding display of common sense, I was quite frankly stunned, has asked that it be put on hold until next year so that they can more thoroughly look at what is in this legislation, and even requested that there be public consultation. Now, this was basically just introduced to Parliament to say, here it is, let's put it through because terrorism. And yes, politicians actually stood up against that reasoning and said, no, let's take it slower and look at this properly. Wow. Again, common sense in Parliament. Wow. Now, the person they got to introduce this bill, Malcolm Turnbull, he's probably actually one of the most tech-savvy guys in the Australian Parliament, and I can just see him at night going, why am I forced to introduce this terrible stuff? Anyway, he's been out and about talking up the importance of data retention and why it is important. A slight problem, though, is when he was the opposition communication spokesperson, back before the change of government, he had quite a passionate, logical, and, well, excellent speech, speaking out against data retention when the previous government even deemed mentioning it. They hadn't even introduced it in Parliament yet. This speech is kept on his website. It's a matter of public record on the Coalition website. And you know what? Funnily enough, people started digging it up and saying, hey, look, here's what Malcolm Turnbull said just 2 years ago, completely contradicting what he's telling us about this legislation. Now, in a not-so-sensible move, well, we don't know if Malcolm Turnbull himself or if just some crony within the coalition government decided it was a good idea to try to remove that speech. That's not going to work. The internet is not going to forget. And all that did was bring more attention to the speech in the first place. Don't mess with the internet, guys. It will turn around and bite you. Moving on from that, regular listeners will know that I'm quite the advocate of using, say, a VPN service to access cheaper digital services from overseas. But, you know, you can also just simply buy physical products and get them shipped to Australia cheaper than you can buy them in Australia anyway. Been common knowledge for years. Problem being, of course, that some stuff will not actually ship to Australia. Particularly if you go to Amazon, there is a lot of content there which says ships to US only. And to get around this, there are forwarding services, mainly based in the US, that people have also been using. Adds a bit to the cost, but you know, you weigh up the balance and usually you can still save a few dollars, particularly if you, say, group purchase with somebody else. What has come out in this past fortnight is Australia Post themselves have launched their own forwarding service. So you sign up to this, you will get a US postal address that Australia Post will then use its services to forward from the US to you here in Australia. Look, this is a great idea and would be absolutely fantastic if Australia Post's service could match those of the ones that already exist. Not going to happen for quite some time, I feel. Plus, the actual pricing of the service is less competitive than those that are already out there. So, it is a step in the right direction. It's good to see it happening, but it still needs a bit of work because, frankly, it's an Australian service, and guess what? We pay more to use an inferior product. Funny that. Now, the Netflix to Australia rumours are bounding out again. It was found out that Netflix spoke to an Australian publicist company, and of course, everyone's thinking, they're getting ready to advertise Netflix in Australia. Netflix still hasn't concerned anything. If it's going to happen, look, guys, it's still quite some time away, and we'll probably just end up like, say, UK Netflix, where half the subscribers still use a VPN service to access the US version because it's better and cheaper. Am I a broken record? Really? Do I have to be a broken record? Oh boy. Speaking of streaming services, there was a bit of a breakup over the past fortnight too, when Taylor Swift announced that she was pulling all her music off Spotify because they don't pay enough royalties on her music. I don't like this argument for a number of reasons. Look, I'm all for artists getting paid. That's fine. But essentially, this is a radio service. Yes, it's on demand. The artist, I don't know what the comparison is, but really, their airplay on radio is going to get them a minuscule amount. Do they want all their music taken away from radio? And with radio, it's like set playlists. And look, if somebody is a big fan of a particular artist, they're going to play their music a lot more on Spotify, meaning that they will get more money from Spotify than radio. My real bugbear with this is, though, that these stories and this sort of stuff never mentions the fact that the record labels themselves charge hundreds and millions of dollars to each service individually to license their libraries for playback on those services in the first place. Yet we never hear, what do the artists get from that? I guess the artists don't want to go against their labels because they feel that will make their life more difficult. But hey, look, if you're getting money from a service and you don't feel you're getting paid enough, then you take your music away from that service, you're not getting any money from that service at all. Logic? Anyone? Hey, let's talk about something good on the internet though, okay? The Internet Archive, which I love, if you wonder where we get our wonderful logo from of Gamera the Giant Monster and our little snippets of old 78 and wax cylinder music that you hear spaced between our segments, it's all from the Internet Archive. Archive.org. Their public domain section is absolutely fantastic. And it's being expanded. For a while, they have had online emulators with a number of games from old systems available. Very cool. What's even cooler is it has expanded, and they now have over 900 titles available for you to play. 900 classic arcade games have been added, to be precise. I mean, not just obscure stuff, you've got like stuff like Defender, Pac-Man, Q-Bert's in there. Street Fighter 2 even gets in there. This is some pretty awesome stuff. And yes, I do love the Internet Archive. I'll chuck a link down below as well, just to make it easier for you to find. And I guess that's a nice happy way to finish the geek news.
With my birthday fast approaching on the 18th of November, I thought, hey, why not look back at my top 10 favourite movies? Being such a movie buff and screening movies in my line of work, I'm constantly surrounded by the motion picture. And coming up with my top 10 was quite difficult, and it has been a list that I've been working on for quite a few years, adding to, minusing from, even creating a secondary list for guilty pleasures and other movies that are worth a mention. These films are some of the greatest ever made. I bloody love these movies. We start off in the 60s with Breakfast at Tiffany's from 1961. Audrey Hepburn being my favourite actress and probably very influential in encouraging my love of classic movies, Breakfast at Tiffany's is one of those iconic movies that almost can't really be deemed a cult film because it is so mainstream, but it is so iconic. Even people that haven't seen the movie know the song Moon River and are familiar with Audrey Hepburn's wardrobe in the film. A gorgeous slice of 60s New York. It gave hints at the fashions and the look that was about to permeate through films later in the decade. In 1964, following the wave of Beatlemania, band The Beatles released their debut film, Hard Day's Night. Celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, it ranks possibly one of the greatest films of all time. It follows a day in the life of the Beatles, interwoven with footage of them performing on a show and rehearsing for that. There's also interesting plot things added in involving Paul McCartney's grandfather and featuring a plethora of early 60s Beatles tunes. If you want to see the Beatles before they started to go a bit crazy and Help and you know, definitely Magical Mystery Tour later in the 60s, see Hard Day's Night when these fresh-faced boys from Liverpool get up to all sorts of mischief. And honestly, if you do not fall in love with Ringo after watching this movie, there's something wrong with you. But it wasn't to be all Givenchy dresses and Beatles pop in the 60s. In 1960, Alfred Hitchcock released his seminal horror film, Psycho, so influential it is still copied today and was almost responsible for creating the slasher genre that we know from the 80s and beyond. Another iconic film that even though you might not have seen it, you will be so familiar with the image of Janet Leigh screaming and being murdered in the shower. It's the stuff of legend. Alfred Hitchcock created a whole new boom and a whole new genre and really pushed the envelope of what can be shown in film. Did you know Psycho is the first movie to actually show a toilet? Interesting fact. Whilst on the subject of horror films, we move into the 1970s, possibly my favourite era, both of fashion, culture, music and film. The horror classics continue with Texas Chainsaw Massacre from 1974. Celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, I managed to see the film on the big screen last week, and nothing has been able to take away its power to punch. Despite its name, very little gore is seen in the film, and Tobe Hooper, as I noticed the other night, does a great job of building tension and really setting this up to be almost documentary style, like what you're seeing is actually happening. Pretty much the second half of the movie consists mainly of screaming, and Marilyn Byrne should really take out the title of being Scream Queen. A bit tamer, but still very influential, Carrie from 1976, pretty much responsible for the teen school movie. You know, it paved the way for Mean Girls, Heathers, and other films of recent times. Brian De Palma, one of my favourite directors, who has quite an eclectic filmography. Carrie was a big mainstream success for him. It was also the first movie adaptation of a Stephen King book. They actually spell his name wrong in the opening credits. And it also was nominated for an Academy Award for Sissy Spacek, who played the lead role of Carrie, and Piper Laurie, who played her mother. But it became another occasion, alongside The Exorcist, where a lot of big Academy Awards were being awarded to a horror film, something that was still quite new in the 70s. Midnight movies of the 70s flourished in New York, and I imagine if I'd been alive to experience it, that would have been my hangout. It's where movies like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and John Waters' Pink Flamingos got to flourish, and really had their initial start to go on to become the cult classics they are today. John Waters took his film Pink Flamingos in 1972 to New Line Cinema after they said to him, come back to us with something a lot more polished and something that we could play at midnight. So John Waters went away with his Dreamlanders, his group of people around him, his actors and his crew, and came up with Pink Flamingos, one of the most vile, disgusting, and stupid movies of all time, said Variety. But it's also one of the funniest movies you'll ever see. In between rolling around the floor, you'll be secretly vomiting in your mouth a little bit. The end of the film is Divine eating, let's just say, some doggy do. I'll leave it at that. And I believe in Queensland, a lot of these scenes that were quite controversial were actually cut out of the prints up here. I can imagine half the movie would only have been screened. There's even a scene involving chicken sex, which unfortunately I cannot watch, and it really pushes the boundaries for what was acceptable. Johnny Knoxville has gone off to say that John Waters of Pink Flamingos influenced Jackass. And I can easily see why, but still a fantastic movie because of the dialogue, the situations, the performers, and hey, it's John Waters. It's so hard for me to decide on a favourite movie of all time. For years it had been the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and then along came Beyond the Valley of the Dolls from 1970. Russ Meyer, who'd made a bit of a history of being king of the nudies, doing influential softcore movies like Vixen and The Immortal Mr. T's. Signed to the big studio 20th Century Fox, he came out with Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, a film he co-wrote with movie critic Roger Ebert. It's got everything and the kitchen sink, starring a plethora of Playboy playmates and featuring the band The Strawberry Alarm Clock. Words cannot explain the impact that this film has had on my life. It's almost one of those movies that as I watched went, wow, someone's made a movie for me. Finally. I enjoy bringing it out every few months and exposing it to people. You need only look back at previous podcasts to see that the Rocky Horror Picture Show constantly surrounds me. It is involved in my work. It's involved, you know, by being one of my favourite movies. And this, alongside Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, has been extremely influential, both in the friendships and the relationships that I've had in my life and, you know, my career, essentially. A 1975 movie musical based on Richard O'Brien's stage play from London in 1973, the Rocky Horror Picture Show bombed when it first was released. Audiences didn't know what to make of it. 20th Century Fox didn't know what to do with it. Released the following year as a midnight movie, then went on to win the hearts of legions of fans, and still continues to this day, almost 40 years later, to be one of the most successful films of all time. Not bad for something that was made for $1 million. People have been watching Rocky Horror for the last 40 years, and I have no doubt they will be watching it for the next 40 and beyond. You may have noticed my list has only had 9. It's been teetering between 9 and 10 for a long time. What's going to be the 10th idea? Well, it seemed like a really obvious choice. A movie that from the age of pretty much 4, I would watch every day. Someone gave me a copy of the movie when I was 5, and I then went on to watch it every day. Ladies and gentlemen, it is The Wizard of Oz. Possibly one of the most popular films of all time and one of the most seen movies, it is also the most influential. I could pretty much safely say it influenced every movie that was made since 1939. So I have no problem in adding that to my list of top 10. Other notable mentions, I've got All About Eve with Betty Davis from 1950, Casablanca, the classic from 1942. Gosh, I could watch that on repeat all day. And then a couple of little guilty pleasures like Grease 2, moving on, and the beach monster musicals Horror of Party Beach and Beach Girls and the Monster. I've got all excited now. I feel like popping Casablanca into the DVD player.
Nick Dunn, you're probably the most hated man in America right now. Did you kill your wife, Nick?
There is quite a big problem when it comes to reviewing Gone Girl. Now, I really did enjoy this movie, and there is a lot to like about it. The trouble is, though, I really can't tell you about 90% of it. It really is one of those movies that you'll find extra value and extra enjoyment from the less you know about it. So I suppose giving you a bit of a setup of it, I'll stick with pretty much what's in the trailers. So you have married couple, Nick and Amy Dunn, played by Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike respectively. And Amy disappears in mysterious circumstances. As time goes by, suspicion starts to shift, and we wonder if Nick is really the devoted husband he says he is. I won't go any further than that. Let's just say that this is a movie where a lot of the details you don't want to know about before you get to the movie itself. What I can talk about, though, is the actual performances and, I suppose, the setup of the movie itself. Now, Ben Affleck, got to admit, I haven't been too keen on a lot of his more recent stuff, but he really does shine as Nick Dunn. And Rosamund Pike as Amy is also superb. They both put in very strong performances, and oh, God damn it, I still can't talk any more about that side of things either. The movie itself is pretty much broken into 3 very distinct acts, each one building on top of what's happened before. It's quite a good, clever move, and it does keep the movie feeling quite fresh throughout. Act 2 does get a bit long-winded at one point, and I did find that Act 3 was a lot slower paced than the previous stuff, but still very compelling and very enjoyable. The supporting cast also do excellent job. You have Neil Patrick Harris doing a very different role to what you're probably used to seeing him as. Certainly no Barney in sight here. Carrie Coon plays Margot Dunn, Ben Affleck's twin sister, and she adds so much to the movie. She is a very, very strong character. You have Kim Dickens as the detective, Rhonda Boney, whose matter-of-fact manner and general behaviour, never seen without a coffee in her hand, she also adds a great deal. I mean, really, I could probably just list the entire cast and say how great they are. This movie also doesn't just deal with this mysterious disappearance of Amy, though. It's also a bit of a look at the way the media handles situations like this. You have your Fox News style, or this big, buffy, blonde-headed bint, essentially lambasting Nick Dunn and basically accusing him outright of killing his wife. You also have your more thoughtful 60 Minutes type interview a bit later on as well, which has a whole different side. You've got people actually stepping up and playing the media and going to the media just to cover and have their say, even if they have no idea about the people that they're talking about. There is quite a good little segment in there where you have like an analyst that's going, well, I don't know these people, but I think these people are like this. If you're anyone who has ever considered the media coverage of stuff like this sensationalist, over the top, and completely wrong, it's going to give you another reason to enjoy this movie. And that's really all I can say. So, in a nutshell, Gone Girl, it's a great movie with great performances, and go in there knowing as little as possible. The less you know, the more you are going to enjoy what comes your way. Okay, definitely, go see this one. You will not regret it.
How was your marriage, Nick?
Are you asking me if I killed my wife?
Man of my dreams. This man of mine may kill me.
What about my son, Nick?
This man may kill me. In her own words, this man may truly kill me.
This podcast's redeeming feature movie, we thought we'd actually go back to the classics. There are a number of movies that always turn up when you dig up a list of worst movies ever, and this one generally rates very, very highly. In fact, it has been called by various people the best worst movie ever. So what we have for you this time around is the, well, I suppose, absolute schlock fest of Troll 2. This was the first time that I have had the dubious pleasure of watching this movie. I'm not too sure about Christian. I think, Christian, you were saying you have seen it previously.
Yes, I had seen bits because of its cult status in the last few years. In particular, I had decided to actually give it a screening back in 2012. So I did sort of brave a screening that was in between, coming in and out, at the theatre. So I actually sat down for these redeeming features to see the entire thing from start to finish. And whoa, in one go, it's, quite insane. And whilst I think of it, I need to tell the audience, don't be scared off the fact this is called Troll 2. It is nothing to do with the first movie. I happily screen this movie as a standalone because you do not need to see any movies before or since that are to do with trolls, because this is the ultimate troll movie, apparently. The interesting thing is, titled Troll 2, it does not actually feature any trolls in the picture at all. It's actually goblins. Troll, the first movie was from 1986, 87, I believe, and it had some, fairly biggish names, especially big compared to Troll 2. When a movie called Goblin was made in 1989, to cash in on the original Troll movie, they decided to call this Troll 2. And as I mentioned, there has no references to trolls whatsoever in this, and really it should have been called Goblin. But I think with a movie so messed up, it's expected that the title would be just equally messed up as well.
Yeah, I think the fact that the title is completely misleading to the movie itself may be one of the least of its problems.
Oh, definitely. In many ways, it just sort of, it adds to what is about to unfold before you. And really, what does unfold before you in a series of quite bizarre and interesting scenes is, I suppose, to me, one of the key shots, frolicking trolls in a forest. Well, sorry, I mean goblins, I should say, and inserting a cheesy 80s soundtrack. That is how we launch into Troll 2, the MGM 1990 film. it seems to set off so many curious and strange situations that happen. And I say 80s soundtrack because May in 1989, it was still coming out of that period. A lot of girls wearing leotards, and there's that scene where she's doing the weights and the push-ups and things like that, very much like a scene out of an 80s aerobics movie. and that this is all happening all within the first 5 or 10 minutes. It's about to unleash this movie on you. But maybe I'll get Trevor to do a bit of a sum up, maybe a very quick, maybe a couple of sentences on the plot of what you can gather of it anyway, because I think it can be summed up quite quickly.
Okay, well, I mean, certainly with the redeeming features, I know we've said it before, look, straight up, there are always going to be spoilers in the redeeming features. So, straight up, there's going to be spoilers. If you don't want to be spoiled for Troll 2, I feel sorry for you. So essentially what we have is we have a ghost grandpa doing his best to scar a little kid for life with horrifying stories about what the goblins will do to you. Family of kid, the most detached family you've ever seen in your life, decide to go for a family holiday and pick the quiet country town of... Hang on, I'm getting this right now. Niblog. to visit and do a swap with a farming family out there. They get out there. Niblog's a very, very strange place. There is a freaky, freaky woman doing, I don't know, it's a cross between a librarian, Magenta from the Rocky Horror Show, and just plain insanity, and a whole bunch of extremely ugly frolicking goblins who are all vegetarian but still eat people.
Oh, and, you know, the vegetarian being the key, and I won't give away, you know, I know we mentioned the spoiler, I won't give away one of the key very ending bits that involves possibly a sandwich, let's just say. It is interesting that they are all vegetarians, and everything they eat or try to give to the family to eat has this, oh, almost fluoro green colouring on it, almost like they were trying to push that whole troll goblin sort of feel the entire way through the movie. And it almost becomes really off-putting in a way, and especially when you've got a movie that's filmed almost like, I don't know, you could even say a B-grade movie, but it would be insulting a B-grade film. This is the lowest of low production values. Now, mentioned earlier, you said the very disjointed family. I don't know if that was the word you used, but... they are possibly some of the most strangest actors or characters ever seen on film. And you can definitely tell these people aren't a family in real life because there really seems to be no chemistry within them whatsoever. Look at the mother. She just seems to walk around with these wide eyes the entire time, almost just spitting out the dialogue like she's just reading it off a cue card.
Yeah, I think the fact that the kid who I guess is the hero of the movie, He is a terrible, terrible actor, but he's the best actor in the movie.
Oh, look, he's the camp value, even though there's so much camp in it. He is, it seems to say, always involves these big lips and his really wide open mouth. Like, every line he's saying is wanting this to be a memorable quote from this film. And he says some of the, you know, towards the end, he makes reference to one of his family members and goes, "They're eating her!" And then there's, you know, but that also leads me into some of the other dialogue that they have, you know, like one of the key lines that you hear a lot of cult movie buffs quote, "They're eating them, then they're going to eat me! Oh, my God!" And that's not me slowing that down. That's exactly how that guy says it. Mm. I've got one particular quote here. I've sort of done a bit of a segue into the script, but there's one particular scene where the girl's boyfriend sneaks into the to her bedroom window, a scene that's been replicated many times before. And her response to this, of course, is, "If my father caught you, he'd cut off your little nuts and eat them." As every good girlfriend would say.
Absolutely.
And I do remember seeing Best Worst Movie. You mentioned earlier that it's known as that. But Best Worst Movie from 2009 was a documentary where they went back and found the cast members and the makers of Troll 2. And surprisingly, pretty much everybody except the mother came back and were happy to attend a screening and speak happily about the movie.
I'll just say, yeah, that same scene, I mean, yeah, you got that line, but you forgot to mention what he says to her. And I've got the quote here on the IMDb page. "I'm the victim of a nocturnal rapture. I have to release my lowest instincts with a woman."
Every line just reads like, oh, trash.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. In Best Worst Movie, they interviewed the guy who actually wrote it. And I believe, I'm not sure of the nationality, he may have been Italian. And I think that he'd written this, and because of the language barrier and the translation, a lot of the lines just became completely lost. Even on set, they were saying, you know, we can't say these lines. People don't say this stuff. And they just said, look, do it, you know. I wrote it, do what I say. So it's interesting when you look at it like that, but I think there's definitely more than just a language barrier happening with that script.
I mean, if it existed back then, you could have assumed that it was written in another language and then just put through Google Translate and read verbatim without any further tweaking.
Oh, you do realise by putting it through Google Translate, it would have resulted in a better film, wouldn't it, Trevor?
Potentially, or maybe, you know, the whole thing where you do multiple Google Translates and then work out what is at the end.
But you mentioned earlier the disappearing and the reappearing grandfather, who yes, he does disappear and reappear quite a lot in the film, and I think it's hilarious that early on that he's having these nightmares about seeing his granddad and his mum sitting on the end of the bed almost chiding him for thinking about him 6 months on. How could you still be grieving him? Banish him from your mind. I think that's what her line is, and I'm just like, this is so bizarre. So,
yeah, well,
and so from the outset, yeah, you can tell it's quite a cheap movie. So.
Yeah. There's no way that those parents, if they were the real parents, you'd think someone would be calling family services pretty quickly. I mean, there was another scene in the town itself, and if you have a think about the name of that town, you'll get what it actually is pretty quickly. But there's one point where the kid is just absolutely freaking out. They go into town to go to the store, the kid and his father, and the kid realizes what the town name actually means and starts going nuts very quickly after they get there. In the meantime, while kid is having a freak out, dad's going to sleep.
Oh, maybe it'd been a long shoot.
He's like, he's there, he's talking to the kid freaks out, like 5 seconds later, and dad's just fast asleep beside the car.
Which makes you think the whole thing may have just been in the kid's mind. I was even trying to, when the movie finished, when I watched it today, I thought, is there a way to look at this logically and go, maybe it was all a dream, you know? But then you think, no, this guy... You know, it was bad from the first shot, you know. I just thought maybe it could have been, his grandfather reading him this story and he's fallen asleep and had this terrible dream. But no, I think it's actually happening. Poor sod. And there's another, gosh, there's so many scenes I could reference here for the audience, but... there's, one particular scene later on where he gets seduced by the librarian / magenta /...
psycho.
Seductress. And let's just say he's eating, I think she gives him the cob of corn, or he's eating a cob of corn. And
they kind of eat it together. It is actually one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen done.
Oh, yes.
Corn cob in a movie that's not rated very much for a higher audience.
Oh, look, one of the most bizarre bizarre scenes I've ever seen in a movie in my entire life. And it's really quite strange. Let's just say we go from cobs of corn to, sexual encounter to popcorn.
Yeah,
and the guy waking up almost fulfilled the next morning or later on with just swimming in popcorn. And I don't know if it's some kind of metaphor or I don't know. So, but it's definitely one bizarre film and scene. and film.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm stumbling over it. I can't believe it, but it's just so bad.
I mean, yeah. I really can't think of any actual redeeming feature for this movie. I know it's called the best worst movie. Is it not the worst movie? It's close. Looking at stuff we've watched before, I was finding myself thinking, does this rival Blood Rain, which is still the worst movie I've seen in all year? But I find the fact that Blood Rain actually had actors who should know better in it means that it still is worse than Troll 2. So probably that is about the only thing. I mean, aside from seeing some of the worst dialogue ever written and some of the worst acting ever written and, oh my God!
Some of the best quotes of all time.
Yep. This movie, I can give it the fact that it is still a little bit better than Blood Rain.
Oh, and that sounds like, you know, that sounds like something that should go in the video case for Troll 2. It's got to have something to redeem it.
Absolutely.
But look, as I've been sitting here, I too have been struggling, you know, I've got a big question mark next to redeeming features, and, you know, I've managed to sort of scrounge up that it is entertainingly bad, you know, like, it's an hour and 29 minutes of, okay, fair enough, I was kind of going, is this going to be finished soon, but it didn't plod, it was entertainingly bad and consistent the entire time too. Like, it'd definitely be a great party movie, you know, turn the sound up, have a few drinks with friends, and, you know, it's a laugh a minute. You know, there's no real lulls at all in the film. And I think for that, you know, even though, you know, I get chided myself for using the term so bad it's good, this is probably one of those films where it really does apply more than ever, where you can enjoy it because it really is just so bad. There is nothing to redeem it. It's so irredeemable that it almost then becomes redeemable by being a bad movie. So I think entertainingly bad, and is just so campy and over the top. And for a movie released by MGM, and from what I understand, MGM were always the original distributors, you know, a company that really should have known better. You know, they should have just released another James Bond movie or something. But hey, Troll 2 is out there. It exists. I definitely think you need to see it at least once in your life. And for those people who see it and want to sort of explore further, and even yourself, Trevor, if you are interested in this, there is a best worst movie, which is quite entertaining, especially hearing some of the anecdotes and from some of the cast members, and especially one of the scenes where they go to the door of the lady who played the mum and almost beg her to come back for this reunion, and she flat out refuses. I think she's hoping 1990 was where Troll 2 was dead and buried.
Yeah, indeed. And now, I mean, I can't be as generous as Christian just was. I certainly did find it painful going at times. I will give it the fact that just when I thought it was going to be too painful to bear, something bizarre happened. And it's just like, did they seriously just do that? And it got me interested again. So there you go.
Yeah, that was their big saving grace. So if you can track down a copy, or, you know, or perhaps we've turned people, well, I don't think we have really recommended anyone to watch Troll 2 in a way, but if you're a fan of cult classics and want to be, you know, like myself, and want to see all the ones that have such a big reputation or a name that but you might not have ever actually seen the movie, Troll 2 is definitely one of those movies. And I believe you can get it as a double pack with the first movie. Oh, gosh, it's funny, even as I look at the case right now, seeing the way that they try and lump the two in and try to associate the two and just fail miserably. They've got one of the goblins from Troll 2 and managed to sort of amalgamate it into some sort of creature that looks a bit like a troll. So, quite interesting. So, so see if you can pick up Troll 2, and one day I'll see Troll 1 and let you know what I think.
I wish you the very best of luck for that.
Thank you. It's not on my to-do list at the top.
Fair enough. Excellent. Well, if we have somehow piqued your interest in Troll 2, or you have seen it previously, let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the movie, and specifically, what you think of us for pointing you in the direction of this film. And of course, if you have any suggestions or challenges for movies that you would like us to see and try to redeem, Well, look, we've been through Troll 2, we've been through Godzilla was another terrible one. We've been through so many bad movies, you know, that we are getting good at this, and we want your challenges. So certainly send those through.
Definitely, and look forward to hearing what people think or don't think about the movie.
Yep. Okay, thanks, Christian. If you're a long-term listener of the podcast, first up, thank you very much. Appreciate it. You may have heard from our next guest a couple of times before. He is part of the YMCA team, who have done a couple of things now. And he also played Danny in the Grease Interactive Floor Show not too long ago. But we've actually got him for a completely different reason tonight. So, Willem, welcome to the Rufus Project.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for interviewing me.
My pleasure. So, it's been a little while since I guess we've seen you up on the stage. You also have had a couple of appearances as Eddie in the Rocky Horror Show. But you've got something a little bit different coming up. What can you tell us about it?
Well, it's my first trying very, very hard to be professional theatre production. So the difference between this and a floor show, which is what I've been doing most of the time, and what your listeners will know me for, is that we actually speak in this one, which is terrifying because I don't think my voice sounds that good.
I'm sure the listeners will agree you have very dulcet tones.
Everyone sounds horrible when they're recorded.
Only to themselves.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the hope.
Excellent. So what is this this live acting experience that you are bringing to us?
Yes, okay. This is August Strindberg's A Dream Play. It's a play written in 1902, and I guess not a lot of people know who August Strindberg is. He was a crazy Swedish playwright who is one of the few writers in the world who's ever been compared with Shakespeare, because he was very, very good at his job. And this particular play, A Dream Play, when he wrote it, he went through a period of psychosis where he thought witches were trying to kill him. And finally, when he came out of his psychosis, he put it on stage, and it became, at the time, his most popular and well-known piece of work. But since his death, it's become more of one of the obscure ones. And the reason for that is it has about 40 characters, and it's not an easy thing to do.
No, I can imagine. So do you have 40 people up on stage at once, or is it...
No, we've managed to make do with just about 8 people on stage. We've got 2 dancers to have some wonderful dance breaks, and that would make it 6 actors. I should know this better. 6 actors doing all the spoken parts, and everyone's interchanging at least 2 characters. So there's many, many quick costume changes and many, many different voices. Everyone's using their vast repertoire of comedic voices on stage to sound like different characters so that you know who's who. But a lot of people have the same face.
Sure. Right, yeah. And I guess, what is your role, or perhaps roles by the sound of things, in the play?
Roles is a very correct way of putting that. Well, I started out as just the director. I guess it was entirely under my own steam that I wanted to do this, and this was in January. I wanted to do an expressionist play, which is the style of theatre we're going for, and so I searched around, found A Dream Play. I always knew about August Strindberg, I always liked him, and A Dream Play seemed like it would be a challenge, which probably in hindsight was something I should have thought a bit more are about, because it's been really difficult. But, so yeah, I was the one who decided to do this, so I started out as the director, and I become a producer as well, assistant producer, co-producer, whatever you like to put that as, with Dee Dee Leslie, who's a wonderful person. And now, in the week we have left to go, well, it didn't actually happen this week. It was about a couple of months ago. As with every production, you have ups and downs. One of our downs was we've had a few actors drop out. We've had to shuffle things around and replace people. And I decided quite foolishly to take on the role of the poet, which is one of the larger roles in the play. So I'm an actor, director, and unfortunately producer as well.
No pressure.
No pressure. No pressure.
Wow. That's a pretty impressive collection there, especially if it's your first... So is your first attempt at directing a play?
Oh, well, yes. Like, I've directed theatre scenes and things in university and high school, but this is completely independent. This is not attached to any theatre festival, tertiary education system. This is just me. And, yeah, it's the first time I've done this. Hopefully it will go well.
Excellent, excellent. Now, I know we're going to be cutting it a bit fine with this podcast, but certainly... by the time this airs, I'll put up a few links and a few shares via the Twitter feed, Facebook, etc.
That's so cool.
So if anybody wants to come along to see a dream play, I suppose you better let us know the when and where.
Okay, the when and the where. We are performing at Metro Arts on the 7th, 8th, and 9th of November. And that's this coming weekend. It's really, really soon. So I'm at the stage where I'm freaking out a bit, because I'm just praying everything's going to go just right. And hopefully it will.
I'm sure it'll be fantastic. Are you bringing any of the experience from interactive movie screenings to bear with, I suppose, some of the theatrics?
Massively so. I guess the thing people don't really realize with all of the floor shows, it's all mime. It's all really, really heavily theatrical. I think, you know, Christian's floor shows are one of the larger mime things there are in Brisbane. I think they don't really see that. It's a massive skill that, you know, we've all gained doing this. And, bringing that heightened theatricality into theatre with words and talking and everything, it doesn't always work, but expressionism, the style of theatre that I'm going for, is massively heightened. The idea is that, you know, if a character in the play is in pain, they're not just in pain, they're in agony. If they're in love, they're absolutely infatuated, they're obsessed, they're so passionate. It's the absolute heightened, most heightened emotional state for every single character. It's a massive roller coaster ride. And with the floor shows, you know, everything physically we do with that is massively heightened. So it was really easy for me just to step in and perform that way. But I found having to teach people how to be that overly theatrical, that hammy on stage and make it work, that was something that other people don't know about. And so I've definitely used that skill.
Fantastic. Okay, well, hopefully by the time people hear this, I'll have already clicked on the shares in the various feeds, but if not, if you look right down below, there's all the details are going to be in the podcast description. Admittedly, this is going up on the first night of the play, but if you listen to this straight away, you've still got Saturday and Sunday to get there, guys. Do it. Well, that's great. Well, thanks very much for talking us to us tonight, Willem, and yeah, definitely thanks for talking to the Rufus Project.
No worries, it was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
It's time to have a bit of a look at my upcoming events for November and December. Not too much happening in November, but we're really excited to be able to bring back Tommy Wiseau's The Room to New Globe Theatre on Wednesday the 12th of November. This sold out last time. Believe it or not, one of the worst films of all time, but one of the best films to experience with an audience. Get your plastic spoons together, put on your long black wigs, and get along to experience this movie. If you've never experienced it before, either in a cinema or watched it at all, I definitely recommend getting along to see it. Tickets may be available at the door, but jump onto New Globe Theatre on Facebook for more details about booking your tickets. On Wednesday the 1st of December, we're screening the Arnold Schwarzenegger 1977 documentary Pumping Iron. Tickets are available at the door for $10. Why not some Disney fun the week before Christmas? We're excited to be screening the original Muppet movie from 1979 on Wednesday the 17th of December. The following night, how about something a little bit darker? Tim Burton classic, The Nightmare Before Christmas. Both of these will include live interaction and entertainment to make this night even more memorable. Details for that will be available soon on my website, so jump onto www.christianfletcher.com for details about these and all of my upcoming events. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Now, Christian has a few less events coming up in the near future, so that means we don't have the nice double movie passes to give away for this particular podcast. But don't you worry, I have decided to step up and offer something myself. I have quite the collection of spare, mainly indie game downloads available through Steam on the PC. Codes galore, and I decided I'd do a bit of a random grab bag competition. So if you would like to head to Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Ustream, wherever you can find us, Podomatic of course, or the list will be available later, and chuck in the comment, game please, I will send you a random code or gift for redemption on Steam. Now, these are all pretty good titles. There are some very famous ones in there and very popular ones, so you won't be disappointed. So again, leave a comment on any of the usual places, just saying, game please, and I will send you something out. Okay? Guaranteed. Good luck. Not that you need it. Thanks so much for listening to the Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. And now, of course, we would love to hear your comments, feedback, requests, suggestions, or competition entries. How to do this? Simplicity itself. Simply find the Rufus Project on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube, on Ustream. Head to therufusproject.podomatic.com, our homepage. Or, you know, look us up on iTunes, leave a review there. We would love to hear from you, and we definitely want your feedback. Don't forget, we also have a Spreadshirt store. We'll be looking at adding new designs as time goes by. But at the moment, you can check out the whole one design at therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au. And if you are someone or you have an event that you think would be suitable to be featured in our local wildlife segment, and remember, on the internet we are all local, so it doesn't have to be based in Brisbane, then definitely get in touch with us at any of the previously mentioned places, or even just send us an email to rufusreviews@gmail.com. And finally, you know what? I can never think of a sign out for this podcast, so we're looking for your suggestions. If you have a suggestion for a sign out, send it through. I'd love to hear them. This podcast, though, the suggestion actually comes from our good friend and interview subject, Willem. So until next time, stay cool, bird boy. Thanks, Willem, and see you next time. For those who do listen this far and know that I normally have a little comment about something in the podcast here, I thought I'd also mix it up at the stinger end. Ooh, how exciting. I was almost going to include this in the news, but I thought, you know what? Nah, it can be a little extra on the end. You may or may not have had the joy of experiencing a call from Microsoft Support. One of the more common scams in Australia at the moment, they ring up, say that they've detected a virus or something wrong with your computer, let you install a Trojan, giving you directions step by step along the way, and then of course they get your credit card details and charge you for all these services and basically rip you off. Very annoying, a lot of the time I just hang up, but you know what? I had a phone call from them, and I thought I would have a little play. So a lady comes on the phone from Microsoft Support, or Windows Support, and saying, we've detected a virus on your computer. We need you to take these steps. I won't go through step by step, that'll take a while. Essentially, once she got me starting to input stuff, I said I had a blue screen of death and that Windows was restarting. She took that in her stride, and while it was restarting, I basically said that a friend of mine had warned me that I might get viruses because of what I look at on the internet. She said, oh, what do you do? And I said, oh yeah, I look at a lot of porn sites, and I was told that porn sites have viruses. Surprisingly, again, she took that in her stride. I thought that would at least elicit some reaction. But we kept on going. I then told her that Windows was installing about 128 updates. She didn't really seem too pleased with that, but she kept talking. With my response being, eh? Yeah? Oh, okay. Yeah? Along the way. Anyway, I kept going for about another 10 minutes all up. I had a few more things planned when she finally said to me that I needed to turn off my computer. I said, well, oh, you mean I should unplug it? And she said, yes, unplug it. She then said, now what you need to do is sit in front of your computer and in about 5 minutes' time, you'll get a message from us telling you to go f*** yourself. And then she hung up. It was glorious. So, if you do get a call from Microsoft or Windows Support, it's really a public service to string them along for as long as possible, because if you know they're scam, at least they're not calling someone who might actually fall for it. Plus, it's a great way to wind down at the end of the day. Just gotta say, felt really good afterwards.